most people, not all, but many people in a toxic environment don't like that it's toxic. So they, if given a choice to create something new and better, they'll often take it. If they're given a voice, they're respected and they're given some tools and clarity about what needs to happen. So I don't know that it's not necessarily easy in the sense that it takes a short amount of time. But if you have enough people who really are invested in doing things differently and helping to change things, it's absolutely entirely possible.
So you're a smart business committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing. And you're asking, what's next? Wondering how you can become even more innovative. My name is Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and this is the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Hi, innovators. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I trust you enjoyed our most recent interviews with Les Watson of Get More Time and Zach Marino of Squadcast. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Claudette Rowley, the CEO of Cultural Brilliance, a cultural design and change management consultancy. Over the past 20 years, Claudette has consulted, trained, and coached executive leaders and teams at Fortune 1000 companies, small businesses, academic institutions, and startups, helping them create proactive and innovative workplace cultures that deliver outstanding results. She lays out a roadmap for organizational success in her new book, Cultural Brilliance: The DNA of Organizational Excellence. Today's episode is brought to you by the Transformational Marketing Hub, where you'll find a host of free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. You can access the hub by visiting innovabiz.co/VIP for very important person. Go check it out. It's free to join. innovabiz.co/VIP. And if you're a member already, just log in to get your resources. In our discussion today, Claudette talked to me about a cultural framework that goes beyond just the beliefs and mindsets that drive behavior. She talked to me about emotional energy within the culture and how to be aware of that energy. And we discussed building a cultural safety zone to allow people to open up, which is when change starts to happen. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Claudette Rowley. Hi, I'm your host Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from the greater Boston area in the USA, Claudette Rowley. She's the CEO of Cultural Brilliance, a cultural design and change management consultancy. Claudette is also the author of the book, Cultural Brilliance, The DNA of Organizational Excellence. Welcome to the podcast, Claudette. It's a great privilege to have you as my guest.
Oh, thanks, Jürgen. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Jackie Lappin, who is my guest on episode 177 of the podcast, suggested we interview you. So a big hello out to Jackie.
Definitely. Hi, Jackie.
Claudette, you work with executive leaders and teams, helping them create a proactive and innovative workplace culture that delivers outstanding results. So I'm really looking forward to digging into that topic in some more detail. But before we start talking about all things culture and leadership, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get to where you are today, and what were some of the pivotal moments in that journey?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I've had my business for almost 20 years. I've been doing executive coaching, leadership and organizational development, and now a lot of work directly with culture. And prior to that, I was in social work. I did a lot of program development and design. And one of the things that happened early in my career was that I had two different jobs, one after the other. And the first one was an organization that had a really great culture. And I was asked to design a new program. I got to do really creative work. I was trusted. I felt respected and like I contributed a lot. And then I moved to a different state in the US. And so I had got a new job, of course. And the second job was, the organization had a culture that we would now describe as toxic, that it was, and probably at the time too, it was described that way. There was a lot of blaming, there was backstabbing, there was favoritism, all the things that we really gossip we don't want in cultures. And although I did great work there and I also designed a new program there, I noticed how my confidence started slipping in the second experience. And although I was early in my career, I even at that point started to contrast and really observe these two experiences and how they had impacted me. And also the role the leaders played, the managers and leaders played in each one of these jobs. And I think that those experiences really set the stage for a lot of what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite startling, the impact that culture and organization has on people's performance, isn't it? Now, when you talk about an organizational culture, what is it that you understand by that? Help us understand that a bit better, because I'm not sure everybody understands the same thing by that term.
Right. It's kind of a nebulous term. What do we really mean by organizational culture? And so culture is often described, and I agree with this definition, as a set of beliefs and mindsets that drive the behavior in organizations. And that behavior is important because it's that behavior that gets our results. It causes us to make decisions in certain ways. It causes us to communicate in certain ways. And then in my book, Cultural Brilliance, that you mentioned, I take that a step further in a way, and I talk about culture as a system of mindsets, behaviors, and structures that sequence and patterns that we often can't see, and sometimes we can if we're looking, but we're often not really looking, so we don't notice them. And these patterns are driving our results, our decision-making, and our communication.
Mm. Yeah, I like the structure and the patterns there, because I think if you consider beliefs and mindsets and what typically happens, I mean, I've been in organizations where they've said things like people are our most valued asset, or the customer is the most important person to focus on, and yet the behaviors on a day-to-day basis don't reflect that. In fact, in a couple of companies I was in, they ended up almost at odds with that stated belief. So I think the structure and the behaviors that are actually hidden, or, well, the behaviors aren't hidden, but some of the beliefs might be hidden. So how does your system get to the core of those kind of issues?
Well, one of the things I do when I work in organizations, businesses, is we do a lot of assessment work up front. And of course, a lot of people who work in culture internally, or consultants who are helping organizations with culture, do assessment work. One of the things that I do in the assessment work is create something I call a cultural safety zone. And that's just another way of saying, how can we make it safe for people to tell the truth about how their culture operates? That's all the great things about it, and they're all the not so great things about it, right? And everything in between. So it's very intentionally and consciously providing an environment in which people can say, okay, it's really hard for me to say this, and this is what I really think is going on here. Right? This is the root cause of why we're having these issues. Or these are the things that make us really wonderful, and wouldn't it be great if we had more of it? So I think it's in that creating that safety over time, and that the ability to tell the truth, that we really start to get to the heart of what's going on. And I believe that saying the truth will set you free, in the sense that once you know that, you can then start to say, what kind of culture do we really need? What do we need to support our business objectives and our people? And then let's design that culture and move that forward. So it's really getting people involved from all different parts of an organization, and then helping harness their potential and move it forward throughout the culture in a very practical way.
Mm. And I'm fascinated. What's the background of the use of the title of the book in terms of the brilliance? So you talk about a brilliant culture. What's the significance of that word, and how does that relate to developing that culture that is, you know, that's going to deliver the performance that gets everybody performing at their peak?
I think, the word brilliance is actually a word I've used before. I wrote a book maybe a decade ago that was targeted more toward individuals, and it was called Embrace Your Brilliance. So I've had the two books are not in a series or anything, but it's a word that's important to me personally and professionally. And I think of brilliance as potential. Mm-hmm. So, and also brilliance of the other ways we think about it, you know, light, invention, intelligence, you know, brightness. There's all these different ways to think about that word brilliance. But I also think of it as potential, that most businesses leave so much potential on the table in the form of their culture. The culture could be so much more than it is. And I'm not saying that just as, because that would be a really nice thing to do. I'm saying it because it actually will increase their business success and their ability to adapt to change. So there's a really functional aspect to having a culture that uses its potential.
Mm. So tell us a little bit more about your cultural brilliance system then, because I really like that concept. And you mentioned a few moments ago about situations where there might be a good culture in place, but it's the company could be better, could perform better if we did more of this, and that kind of requires a bit of an awareness. So I know there's a level of analysis and self-awareness in what you do, but talk to us a little bit more about the system.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, so the beginning piece, the assessment piece is that I already described is called the authenticity phase. And it's what it sounds like. We're getting to the heart of what's really going on and understanding it. And, you know, the system then really, one of the things that I like about the system is that it throughout there are three main phases. And throughout each phase of the process, we're getting feedback from people from all parts of the organization. We're getting their input. So even though we may not actually, it may be a few months before we start making any real changes, change already starts to happen. Because when people have an opportunity to have a voice and to give their feedback and to share their perspective and perception of things, many people start to open up and share ideas and share things that they haven't shared before. So right at the beginning, we're starting to see little pockets of change and evolution. And then the next main phase of the process is called the design or adaptogen design phase. And that's where we take all the information we gathered in the authenticity phase, and we start just talking about designing how we move the culture from where it is now to where we really, really need it to be as an organization. The word, for folks who aren't familiar with the word adaptogen, because I wasn't until a couple of years ago, adaptogens are herbal substances like ginseng or maca as examples that when people take them will help decrease their stress and rebalance their physical systems, their bodily systems. And so a mentor of mine a couple of years ago challenged me and said, what if there could be an adaptogen culture? What would that be like? And I was fascinated by that idea because I think a lot of times, you know, many organizations, at least in the US, we see companies that don't adapt to change well. And, you know, as most of us know, that ability is really important now in our more global environment that's rapidly shifting all the time. So the second phase of the process is simply how do we design a culture that can really adapt to change in ways that actually decrease our stress and increase our learning and success. So I have a process for that an organization goes through. And then once we've designed, we move into implementation, which is called the aware integration phase. And that simply means we're going to plan how we'll implement these cultural designs, but we're going to do it with new self-awareness that by this point we would have identified the mindsets, the behaviors, how people need to think and act differently in order to be in a different culture and create it. But then also you have to implement from this perspective of a different mindset. We can't implement something new from an old mindset, which seems obvious, except that many organizations will not make that connection and we'll start to implement from old mindsets. I can give you an example of an organization that I worked with, if that would be helpful, that illustrates.
Yeah, that would.
So I was working with a manufacturing company again here in the US, and they'd been around for about 35 years, but they went through, even though they'd been around a while, they went through this growth phase, intentionally went through a growth phase, and their sales increased. They'd always done really well with their customers. Their customers loved them. But what they started to see was that they were suddenly having all these operational problems. they're missing shipments. You know, since they're a manufacturing company, that's a big deal. Having a hard time getting product done on time. People's stress level was going through the roof. It was really becoming, it was not sustainable. So the CEO was someone I had already worked with. I had worked with them in the past, and he was telling me about this. And I said, I really think you have an issue with your culture, not just your operations. And he and I talked and decided that I would come in. And what we found in the authenticity or assessment phase was exactly that. Although they were having operational problems, and that, of course, was real, that wasn't the root. The root cause of what was going on was that people in the organization, and some of them had worked together for 20 years, people in the organization were more invested in preserving their relationships with each other than they were with meeting their shipping deadlines. And how that manifested was they weren't willing to have conflict with each other. They weren't willing to solve problems if it was going to require disagreeing with somebody else, right? So they weren't willing to have those kind of debates we always need to have at times in companies to resolve issues. Now, this was unconscious. They weren't aware of this. They didn't walk around saying, you know what, we're not going to resolve problems because we want to preserve our relationships. So it was something, a set of beliefs that had developed in the organization over many, many years. But it was driving almost everything they were doing. And when I showed it to them, you know, they started to see, wow, there's really something here. So we worked, you know, we have worked through that over a series of months and really, you know, taken the culture up to a different level where there's people aren't blaming very much anymore. We've eliminated a lot of the gossip. They're in much better problem-solving conversations, and the operations have improved.
Mm. Yeah, well, the missed deliveries were just a symptom of some deeper cause, right? And that's typically
the case. Yeah, in this case, that was true.
That's typically the case in organizations. There's something not working, and often the organization or the leadership will say, well, let's fix that particular issue. And of course, something else breaks if it's a deeper seated issue, and often it does come back to culture.
Mm-hmm.
So how easy, this is a bit of a Dorothy Dix question, I guess. What are the challenges that people then kind of face when it's about changing a core belief or changing, you know, the mindsets around the day-to-day practices?
Yeah, I think it varies widely. And when I share with folks, you know, the data that we've gathered in the authenticity phase, we have assessed, you know, and a lot of the information's come from them. So I'm not telling them what kind of culture they have. I'm simply sharing, you know, what we've all learned. And they start to see, wow, there are really positive beliefs too, right, that are driving the great parts of a culture. So we're going to keep those. Yeah. It's these other beliefs, we see, wow, they're driving, some of these beliefs are driving behaviors we actually don't want because what the outcomes we're getting don't work for us or don't work for customers, right? So organizations, the challenge is sometimes it's not so much the mindset, you know, as most of us have experienced in different organizations we've been in as employees or consultants, it's changing the behaviors. So then it's looking at how do you change behaviors? So I'm often, you know, I'm very aligned with the organization I'm working with, I'm partnered with them. And so we try to come up with really creative ways to make behavioral changes very easy, aligned. We try to make sure as much as possible, the ideas are coming from the employees that need to make the change. We need to solve this employee A, B, C, D, and E. What are your ideas about it, right? Because if I come up with an idea, of course, right, it's human nature, I'm going to be much more likely to want to implement it than if someone tells me that I have to do something different.
Yeah, that's right. One of the challenges everyone has as a human is we kind of like things to be in our comfort zone and we like the certainty of this is the way things are going to happen. So change is always a bit of a threat.
Yeah, I think change can definitely be a threat. And I'll see, we see people who are early adopters of change, right, who think it's great, all the way to the people who aren't going to change no matter what. And I often will have conversations, and I mentioned this briefly in the book, that it's, you know, or do you not want to change because you think this change is actually a bad idea, right? In which case, let's talk about it. I'd like to hear where you're coming from. Or do you not want to change because it's going to make you uncomfortable, right? Moving out of your comfort zone. And that's a whole different conversation. Like, I have a lot of respect for people who are nervous about leaving their comfort zone, because it's part of how we protect and preserve ourselves as people. So then it's walking through with them, talking it through with an individual or a group around, okay, you know, this is probably going to push you out of your comfort zone. I'm just going to be really upfront, right? So given that that's probably what's going to happen here, what do we want to do about it? How can we make this a little bit easier? And I find that sometimes just saying, you know, saying it, naming it, this will probably be uncomfortable temporarily. This is why, this is what we can probably expect, will often decrease some of that change, fear about change or concern about change by, you know, maybe 50%.
Hmm. You talk in the book about culturally brilliant leadership and the importance of putting people in a place of learning. So the idea of getting out of your comfort zone is definitely putting people in a place of learning. So what are your approaches to take that learning aspect and make sure people are taking that on board in terms of learning new skills or learning a different way of looking at the way their culture operates, their beliefs and mindsets?
Yeah, I think that organizations, you know, one of the jobs of an organization is to provide a culture in which people can learn, right? This idea, as you mentioned, of leaving people in a place of learning rather than defensiveness. So I think that when we're asking people to learn things, which, you know, most of the time we should be in some form or fashion, we need to make sure does it feel psychologically safe, which just means if I actually admit that I made a mistake or that I'm having a hard time learning something, no one's going to make fun of me, nothing negative is going to happen to me, et cetera. I'm not going to be concerned about retribution. So I'm providing a safe environment. Are we providing the tools people need to learn? Are we willing to listen to what their challenges are? Are we willing as leaders to learn from them also? Can learning be a two-way street? And I find when you make learning a two-way street, that learning becomes much easier. You know, if leaders saying, we're all in this together, we're all learning right now because we're creating we designed a different culture. We're creating something new. So we all have to learn to look at things differently. And I think so. It's really, to me, the bottom line is respect. How do we respect people while they're learning and feeling vulnerable? And how do we put structures in place where they can succeed?
So in how you talked earlier about your experiences and that one of the companies you worked with was quite a toxic environment. So how difficult is it to take an organization like that and actually make those changes? Because that would be quite a, to me, that would seem like quite a radical change. And I've been in toxic environments in the past, and I probably been of the belief that I don't think there's going to be a change like that possible without kind of changing a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think if environment's truly toxic, then you're looking, you need a strong leader, right? Someone who is 100% committed. Like this is not acceptable, right? We cannot have a culture like this anymore for all these reasons. And is really leading that. But of course, we know it takes more than just a leader or a leadership team to make a change. So then it's looking at, what behaviors are the leaders role modeling, right? Are they role modeling healthy business behaviors, healthy cultural behaviors, healthy relationship behaviors? So you're looking at that right at the outset. We know if they're not modeling what needs to happen, then nothing's going to change. Everyone's going to see that right away. You know, there's a contrast, right? We're being asked to do something that the leaders aren't doing. But beyond that, I also think it's making it really, really clear for people to talk about, you know, this is what it's been like for me to be in this toxic culture. Give them voice, an opportunity to have a voice around it while also setting new expectations. But what I find is that most people, not all, but many people in a toxic environment don't like that it's toxic. So they, if given a choice to create something new and better, they'll often take it. If they're given a voice, they're respected and they're given some tools and clarity about what needs to happen. So I don't know that it's not necessarily easy in the sense that it's takes a short amount of time. But if you have enough people who really are invested in doing things differently and helping to change things, it's absolutely entirely possible.
Yeah. All right. I'm also curious as to, do you have suggestions around virtual teams? Because in virtual teams where people are working in remote locations and often it's different cultures and language and work practices perhaps that add to the complexity of an organization like that, is there a good way to kind of set a culture in place right from the beginning of an organization like that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's where you need to, I think with virtual teams or organizations, you need to be even more intentional about the culture you're developing. And how do you, like, especially as you said, if people have their own, or coming, you know, maybe working in a different country, so they have their own cultural differences to begin with, or communication differences, language differences, you want to be really intentional about the culture you're going to co-create. Because what I find often gets overlooked is that culture will develop no matter what you do. So you might as well make it the one that you want.
Yeah.
It's always developing. It is always evolving and moving. So being intentional about it, having those conversations overtly, simple questions. What kind of culture do we want to create? What's going to support us working together really well virtually? What will allow us to meet the needs of our, if you have customers, needs of our customers, or the business needs we need to fulfill? And having those intentional conversations. I also think creating virtually as much as you can opportunities for people to connect and get to know each other and build relationships with each other. So when, not if, but when a problem arises, when there's a, you know, a conflict or misunderstanding, there's more of a relationship to go on so that people can resolve things and communicate with each other. Mm. But I think it's building, helping people build those bridges to each other and having tools in place to do that.
Yeah, the relationship thing is really key, isn't it?
It is.
Hmm.
It really, really is.
All right. Now, the other kind of situation, and I've seen this in my own career in the past, is where an organization gets acquired by another organization, or there's a merger of two organizations and they're quite different in their culture. And then I like that you said earlier about, you know, whether we like it or not, there is a culture there, so you might as well be intentional about merging it. How often do you find the situation where two organizations merge, or one organization takes over another organization, and they're not concerned at all about the culture? They don't pay particular attention to it, and it kind of really messes up the merger or the acquisition.
No, I think that happens so often, where culture is overlooked, or it's dealt with in a very superficial way. And I think there is such an opportunity with a merger or acquisition to do a deep cultural assessment of both cultures. Because if you take the best of both organizations, you could end up with something that's richer than you either organization had already, right? Because if you're merging and you're doing it well, you're doing something very intentional. So I think it's often overlooked, and there is a huge opportunity to do it differently. I mean, because if you take the best of both cultures and you align and you treat people with respect and you give them lots of opportunity to give input, to give feedback, talk about their experiences, you can also actually decrease the stress of the merger or acquisition as well. I mean, so you could increase productivity if you're dealing with the cultural issues. So it makes a lot of business sense also.
Mm, yeah. It's something that I think is generally overlooked in those situations. I mean, I've been in a few of those situations, and it's always been around the logistics and the structure at the structural level. So, you know, who's going to have what jobs and where are we going to put the people that are in similar roles in the two organizations? Because obviously you don't want to duplicate on that, but they don't look at the, you know, beliefs and mindsets that drive the cultural behavior and identifying that. And as you say, it's probably a really good way to make the merger or enhance that whole experience of the merger by getting people involved and by intentionally building upon the positives of the cultures of the organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. Such an opportunity.
Mm. All right. Now, you talk also about harnessing the emotional energy within a culture. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so all cultures have an emotional component, emotional energy. Some people call it the emotional culture. But it's really that as human beings, we are coming into work with our emotions, whether, you know, some employers like to pretend that's not true, but it is. And we come in with our emotions. And so there's going to be an emotional tenor to the culture. And it could be what we individually each bring in, but there's also the collective energy, right? The collective emotional energy in a culture. Examples of that would be, do you walk into the organization and, you know, into the office building if it's an office? And you, wow, I can cut the tension here with a knife. Or does this seem like a pretty fun, relaxed place? Or are people really serious, but you could tell they like what they're doing, right? It's intense, but they really like what they're doing. You know, that's part of the emotional energy. And so what a lot of leaders I've worked with have overlooked is that there is this emotional energy in the organization, in the culture. And if you get it moving in a positive direction for that culture, you can get a lot done. And so it's simple things, even like listening to people. What do they have to say? Listening to even things that as a leader, you don't want to hear, right? You really didn't want to hear that, but you're still willing to listen to it. Leaving people in a place of learning. So it's more than even motivating people or inspiring them, although it's part of that. It's noticing what's happening in the energy of the organization and really tapping into that and helping everybody move forward in a positive way that raises the energy.
So there's a high level of awareness there of where people are at and what's going on for them.
Right. Like a simple tuning in, right? That if you're, let's say you're leading a large company meeting, something like that, and you have, you know, 200 people in the room and people seem, and you're announcing a change, right? Common example, you being the leader, if the leader's announcing a change and people are disengaged, maybe they're rolling their eyes, maybe they're on their phones, right? There's not a lot of signs of engagement or respect going on. And you say, well, whatever, I announced the change as a leader. You say, well, whatever, to yourself, right? And you ignore all of that. You have tuned out of the emotional energy of what's going on and missed a big opportunity to check in. Like, okay, I noticed a lot of people at the meeting didn't seem very engaged. What's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, well, of course, that's a fairly black and white kind of example. Typically, it's not as clear as that. So people
might
be...
Right, yeah, more concrete example, that, just for the purposes of an example. But yes, it could be much more nuanced, yeah.
So the importance of actually having the awareness of what the response is to, let's say, that example, the change you're announcing, is really important.
Right. Are people telling you that they think it's a good idea when they really don't, for example, right? Which can happen in some cultures. People just say, yeah, that sounds great. And then they walk away and talk to other people and say, this sounds awful, right? So how do you tune into those nuances?
All right. So now you talked earlier about the structure around culture and the cultural system. And we've also talked about communication, which is really important in having that awareness of what's happening for people in the organization, how are their emotional states. Is there something in that structure and system that you have that kind of ensures that a leader, let's say, would be more aware of what's going on, or at least is checking in for how that emotional mindset is?
I think when a leader starts down the path of a cultural, even assessment, like maybe the leader hasn't decided if there's going to be a change, right? But they do some initial assessment work to find out what's happening in the culture, what's going on, if they need to shift anything. Even doing the act of doing that, I found will help leaders most leaders start shifting into being more tuned into the culture simply because they're learning more about it. Leaders cannot know everything about a culture because they're human and have blind spots. And they only, you know, they can observe, but they aren't always told everything that's going on, right? They may be insulated from some things that are happening in an organization. So they're not necessarily aware of everything. They can't be. So it's that act of assessing and learning and talking with folks, I found very naturally helps them tune in more.
Yeah, it comes back to communication again, doesn't it?
It does. That is a theme.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is fascinating. We could go on talking for ages about culture and how to build a great culture in an organization. I guess one question that came to mind a little earlier is some tips for, I guess, new businesses. If someone is starting a business from scratch and they have a blank canvas kind of thing, what would you suggest? Apart from reading the book, what would you suggest they look at in terms of building the culture from the outset?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think really thinking about what kind of culture might they need to be successful, right? Are they going to need a high innovation culture? You know, things like that. Is it more of an analytical culture because of the industry they're in, right? Maybe they're an engineering company, something like that. So I think really starting to have those initial conversations about what kind of culture they may need to develop. And then I think even more importantly, trust, which we haven't really touched on too much, but how do we build trust? Because I've never seen a great culture that, or even a really good culture that didn't have at least a moderate level of trust amongst folks. So how are they going to build trust with each other? How are they going to resolve issues when they come up? How are they going to be open and honest with each other and tell the truth about things? That's a huge foundation to set the stage for a really great, brilliant culture. So those are the two things I would say.
Yeah, the trust element is really important. And you gave some examples earlier about doing the authenticity
right.
Assessment up front and getting people's opinions on what really is going on. So trust is really important to actually get at the core of those and get people actually contributing. And also when it comes to a point of having people contribute suggestions and so on, trust is really important there as well. Because I think you mentioned the safe zone.
The safety zone, yep.
All right, so you just touched on innovation there, so I think it's a good time to move on to our innovation round, The Buzz, which is designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some insightful answers that'll inspire people to go and do something awesome today.
Great.
So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Give themselves some time and space to notice what really excites them, what energizes them. I found that it is, at least for me, it is challenging to be innovative or to solve problems innovatively, which is more of what I do, but without giving myself time and space to think and reflect, or maybe just not even think about anything at all. So give yourself some space and see what emerges.
Yeah, that's great advice. It is hard to say, okay, I'm going to be innovative now.
Right.
switch, isn't it? Yeah. All right. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
You know, I am someone who generates a lot of too many ideas naturally, but personally, but I think it's stopping working, right? It's giving myself that time and space. It's going to a museum. It's going to, you know, be outside somewhere, do something that at a sensory level inspires me. Hearing a great piece of music, things like that. And then all of a sudden, you know, seemingly, right, the idea that I've been needing pops into my head.
Yeah, that's great advice. I think that is a very underutilized way to solve problems and to, because basically it just clears the mind for a moment.
Yeah.
So I tend to find that if I go out on my morning bike ride, especially if I'm on my own and not talking to anyone, that that it just clears my mind and all of a sudden there's all these ideas pop up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Do you have a favorite resource that you use most often?
A favorite resource? For innovation, the one thing I'm just going to share this because it popped to mind. I don't know that it's a favorite, but I really, really like it. It's a book. I'm just looking for the title here. It's a book called Just Start. And it was put out several years ago through actually in the local Boston area. And what's interesting about the book is it takes you through a process of literally trying out ideas. So just start, like trying out ideas and knowing when to stop and reevaluate and trying out more. So the book is a lot about how to eliminate that back and forth of should I try it, should I not, what should I do, and overthinking. Mm-hmm. So that is a resource that was really helpful to me several years ago, this concept of just starting.
Oh, okay. Sounds fascinating. I'll have to go look that up and we'll share that with the listeners as well. So what's the best way to keep a client on track when, particularly from your experience, when you're doing cultural change work?
Keeping on track, I at the beginning of the process, I'm really clear about what they could potentially expect, although we never know with culture exactly what'll happen. I set the stage of how we'll interact, what they might expect. I think it's staying in close touch, but it's also really, I do a lot of tuning into where objections might be coming up or where they might be starting to get nervous, which makes sense because it's change, right? And addressing that. So try to be really proactive in having those kinds of conversations with clients. And I find that helps. It definitely helps to keep things on track.
All right. That's great advice, being clear about expectations up front as far as you can clarify those, I guess. So what you might expect is a good way to approach it. And then the communication aspect there and being tuned into where people might get nervous. Like it. And the fifth question, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves? Quite apart from having...
What came to mind right away was that authenticity we talked about earlier. Just be yourself. I find when you're being yourself full spades, right? And at full steam ahead, there's something that's really unique and differentiating. And then, of course, you have to turn that into a business opportunity if you're an innovator in business. But there's something about that, really, really knowing who you are and what it looks like to be yourself.
Yeah, I like that you said really knowing who you are and what that looks like, because I think the self-awareness part is quite important there in that being yourself. But the self-awareness of what does that mean to somebody else and what value does that add to somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for getting us through the buzz. So what's the future for your business and the cultural brilliance, the cultural brilliance company?
My book came out actually literally 3 months ago today, January 22nd. Continuing to get the book out into the world, promoting it and letting people know about this perspective on culture, right? And the cultures can be brilliant and there's something really available for them. So that's through my book, speaking, my consulting work. And so it's really moving forward in this next phase.
I was going to ask, is there another book in the works? But if it's only 3 months old, well, it might be a bit premature.
I don't know that I'm ready yet.
Yeah. All right. So, what's the number one piece of advice you'd then give to any business owner that wants to be a leader in their field and a leader in innovation and in productivity?
I think it comes back to culture for me, right? Really, if you want to be a leader in your field and a leader in innovation and productivity and you're leading an organization, right, make sure your organization's set up to be that leader, right? Spend some time on the culture. Really get a sense of, is there anything in this culture that's holding us back from being as great or brilliant as we can be?
Yeah, and then getting people on board with culture and with that drive. All right. Thanks, Claudette. This has been really great. So where can people reach out and find out more about you and the book and maybe even reach out and say thank you?
Thanks so much. So my website is culturalbrilliance.com. And you can find out about me, what my company does, how we help, and the book are all right there. The book is also on Amazon.
Okay, thanks for that. And we'll have links in the show notes to all of those places, to the book and the Cultural Brilliance website. So finally then, who would you like me to interview on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
Oh, wow. I have a podcast radio show also, and I interviewed maybe a year ago roughly the author Michael Mankins, who wrote Time, Talent, and Energy. And I was fascinated by that book and what he talked about in terms especially of how we manage time and energy at work. I think in that it completely relates to innovation, so I would mention him.
All right. Well, that's great. We'll see if we can get an introduction from you and have Michael on the podcast in the future. All right. Thanks so much for sharing your time and all the insights into culture and building a really good culture in an organization with us today on the Innova Buzz podcast. I've really enjoyed this. I've learned quite a bit as well. You've elaborated a lot on some of the aspects that you talk about in your book, and I'm looking forward to sharing this with my audience as well. So I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thanks, Claudette. I hope you enjoyed that engaging and insightful conversation with Claudette, and like me, learned a lot from all the information she shared with us. Consciously building culture within an organization can be quite a challenge, but as Claudette pointed out, culture will develop whether by intention or not. So consciously creating a brilliant culture is definitely a desirable way to do it, and Claudette outlined a whole range of steps we can take in our own organizations to achieve that. I'd love to know what you took away from Claudette's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Claudette Rowley. That is CLAUDETTERROWLEY. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Claudette Rowley. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Claudette there, as well as links to the Cultural Brilliance website, the book, and the other resources we spoke about in this conversation. Claudette suggested we interview Michael Mankins, author of Time, Talent, and Energy, on a future Innova Buzz podcast. So Michael, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Claudette Rowley. Remember to visit innovabiz.co/VIP to access the Transformational Marketing Hub and all its free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. Also, check out our Tales of Marketing Transformation show. You can find that at talesofmarketingtransformation.com. Each episode there will provide you one valuable message to guide you on your journey of marketing transformation. And of course, tune in again next week. We've got more fantastic guests lined up in the Innova Buzz podcast, including business systems consultant Kayla Sloan and the two Adams, Adam Ashton and Adam Jones, from the What You Will Learn podcast. Stay connected. Subscribe to the Innova Buzz podcast so you'll make sure you'll never miss another episode. Head on over to innovabiz.co/subscribe. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because what you think matters to us. Take some of the ideas you've heard today and apply them in your business. Any thoughts, ideas, suggestions, or questions, then share them in the comments below the blog post. And remember, if you want to get better marketing results than you ever have, join our fantastic Facebook community at the Tales of Marketing Transformation Facebook group. All you have to do is go to innovabiz.co/TMA. It's free to join. I hope to see you there soon. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.